sign I was looking for. The helpful diagnostics in this thing, right? Like, it actually says recording. You just have to push the right buttons in the right magic sequence, and there's no menu. All right. All right, so yesterday I asked you folks to think about copy versus revocable copy and which one's the primitive. Okay. So Jay's been quiet here for days.
Which Jay?
You. So, what do you think?
I was thinking revocable copy.
So you think revocable copy is the primitive? Why?
It feels intuitively easier to give up the ability to revoke something than to be able to add it on later.
Add it on later.
Well, like, so if you need both.
Well, wait. You can't give up. In the proposed operation, you can't give up the ability to revoke something.
Okay, well, you can ignore that then.
Okay. All right, so do you want to state it again?
So it feels like it's easier to just ignore your ability to revoke the copy than to somehow add revocability onto a normal copy.
Okay, so your proposition is that do not revoke is easier than adding revocability. Is that a fair capture?
Yes.
Okay. I suspect it's obvious that this is not the position I would take, and I apologize for what we're about to do to this position, but I want to explore it. Okay. So, how many people think this is? I mean, of course, now I've just shot myself in the foot. But how many people sort of agree with this position? It's plausible. It is plausible. It's not an unreasonable position. Definitely not. So why?
Because having a process that was being given a page expects that it can be taken away at any point unless it's very well specified in the protocol that they're using to communicate that this is not going to happen makes sense to me.
So you're saying that a process should operate on the model that its storage can be taken away at any time? Is that what you're saying? I'm not sure I understood you.
When a process would just give it a page by another process.
So if I give you a page.
Right. I should operate under the assumption that you have the right to take that back at any time, unless because of a particular protocol relation and trust relationship that you and I have this additional knowledge that you aren't going to, then it seems reasonable for me to assume you're not. But other than that, yes, my memory can be taken away at any point. And if it is, I may crash, but...
Okay, so I agree with the architectural point you're making that I should assume if I'm handed a resource by someone I don't have a contract with. I mean, look, if I have a contract, we could make a mistake and we could blow the contract. Okay, but that can happen. I mean, right, mistakes happen, right? We're going to have bugs in code. But if I don't have a contract with you about the resource, certainly, regardless of the mechanism, by the way, certainly... I should assume the resource can be made to go away.
This, in some ways, seems like a better fit with the policies we were talking about.
I'm sorry. I want to take that, but I want to finish the thought, okay? What I want to ask you is, so given that we agree about this statement of what kinds of reliance I should have on the contract, is that actually an argument in favor of either of these operations, or is it just an observation about the nature of contract?
Okay, so...
I could take back the resource with either of these designs. Mm-hmm. Right?
Okay, given that stipulation, it's not an argument, per se, for the recoverable copy of the copy.
I want to be clear. I'm not disputing your point. I think your point is exactly right. What I'm trying to establish is whether it bears on this design choice. I think the answer is it does not. Okay.
What I was going to say is it's not that it forces design decision, But in terms of the way that you think about things, what's more natural to do in the system, what's the default capability of the system, it seems like this is a slightly better fit, both to that model and to some of the other things we were talking about yesterday, like, you know, the process that allocates gets to destroy and, you know, all that stuff.
Who's got the eraser? Anybody have any doubts who's got the eraser? It's your turn to throw it at me, by the way. And in the physical world, right, next time you're actually really allowed to throw it. Okay? Because I will throw it at you if you're not paying attention. It's only fair. He doesn't know about this. Okay, my first or second year here, I threw a piece of chalk at Anya Konevsky in my OS class, because she was in the back yakking on her cell phone or something like this. And Anya, being Anya, took the chalk, put it in her backpack, and she came into my classroom the first day of the following year and threw it back at me. Okay? So there's a tradition, and it's okay. All right. In the meat world, right, the world of physical things, right, the nearly impossible case is for us to both have access to the thing, right? I mean, physical things don't tend to honor that property, right? I mean, there's only one of them. And barring the serious advancement of nanotech, which stands a good chance of standing all of our intuitions about copying things on its head, because it turns physical things into information artifacts, potentially. That's a scary thought for another day. It's really hard to share physical things, right? I've got the object or you've got the object. In the information world, executing an exclusive transfer where you get it and I let go is actually the case that takes overwhelming extra work, particularly if you need an assurance that I don't have. Right? If I hand him the eraser, it's not merely that he's now got it, it's that all of us can validate that he's now got it. It's an observable physical fact about the world. Right? If I hand him the capability to an electronic eraser, hell if you know if I've still got it. Okay? The only way we can do an exclusive exchange protocol, right, is by way of a mutually trusted third party. In the monetary system, that third party is called a bank, and this is actually why we have it. Now, that doesn't dispute, that doesn't say that the point you're making is wrong. But you were engaged in applying a meat world interaction to an information, a meat world intuition to an information world interaction. You always want to be really suspicious of that, because very often those things will mislead you.
That's what I carefully said. It seems like, yep, it's more natural.
Fair enough.
I'm not sure that that's a good argument. It just intuitively seems more like a better fit.
Let me ask you this, and I agree it seems like a better fit. Certainly, it's the fit that is more comfortable to us from all of our intuitions as humans. That part, unquestionably. Is that why it seems like a better fit to you, or does it seem like a better fit to you because there's something about information world intuitions that makes it seem like a better fit? Can you say?
I would have to think about it more. I was thinking about it mostly from a perspective of the revocable copy being closer in meaning to the protocol of I give you something, but because I allocated it, I can destroy it.
Okay, let me throw in a new complication here. Okay, there's a difference between the revocable copy operation versus destroy. Even in the non-revocable copy story, the regular copy story, if I destroy the object, it's gone. Okay, so if I fabricate an object, and I do a non-revocable copy of a capability to give, hey, I can still reclaim the storage. I can still take the object back. The difference is, in the destroy case, I'm taking the object back from everybody. In the revocable copy, I'm just taking it back from you. It's personal. Okay? Now, the reason I want to point out this difference is if we're asking what kinds of controls am I left with about my resource, well, I could use either of these mechanisms, but the motivation for a revocable copy, right, has to come from a belief, hopefully, that will justify a new course in architecture, that I want to take it back from you in particular is a sufficiently important operation that I should escalate its importance enough to put it into the deep structure of the system architecture. We haven't established yet whether we should or not. I'm just trying to point out what should our criteria be. And that, by the way, that would be the same criteria for the non-revocable copy. But that's the test. Is this the critical operation? And then secondarily, is there reason to believe that one or the other is actually easier to implement? Easier in the sense not of how hard is the code, but in the sense of is going to fit better with the other design constraints that we'd like to impose to have a robust system. And I will tell you that it's quite likely that my distaste. Sorry, go ahead.
I have a question relating what you're saying now to what we discussed yesterday. Let's say a sender sends an object to a receiver, and then he destroys it.
Who he? The receiver?
The sender.
Sender.
Yeah, so that's reflected in his capability tree. What happens in the receiver's capability tree?
I think what you're really asking is what happens to capabilities when an object gets destroyed? Because there's nothing to do with whether it's in the sender's capability space or the receiver's capability space.
Okay.
The answer is, so look, the end is, the object's not there anymore. Okay? So it's as though you had a pointer and I called free, except in this system, we're not going to allow dangling pointers. Okay? So what's typically done in systems that have an explicit reclaim operation or explicit destroy operation is some mechanism exists so that each time you use a descriptor, there's a check to determine whether the object is still valid. And if it's not, then it's as though you had something conceptually similar to a null pointer, and that null pointer has some well-defined behavior. So in Eros, the answer to this question would be, when an object is destroyed, all outstanding capabilities to that object are efficiently converted into a void capability. And a void capability is a distinguished capability. It's one of the primordial capabilities in the system design. And a void capability is a capability implemented by the kernel such that no matter what you invoke it with, its response is, I don't know how to do that. And by strong convention, its response is the void exception. In fact, in Kiko's, its response was unknown operation. Okay, and there's some debate about whether the void capability shouldn't actually throw a distinguishable exception, but. The key to it is, by strong convention, there was a... So it would say, I don't know how to do that operation. You could then go and say, what type are you? And it would say, I don't know how to do that operation. Okay. And by strong convention, it was the only object in the system that when you ask it, what type are you, it will say, I don't know how to do that operation. And that's how you know it's a void capability. So the answer to your question is the capability becomes unusable, but it becomes unusable in a distinctive, recognizable way. And the actual mechanism is a counter. So the object essentially has a version number and the capability has a version number. If the version numbers don't match, then the capability behaves in all respects like a void capability. So the way you actually do this is when you destroy the object, you just increment the version number on the object. Okay.
That's so there's minimal overhead in terms of the amount of data structures that the OS has to do.
Yeah, it's a word in each capability and a word in the object header.
But this assumes that the object is going to stay forever.
No. Right? No, it doesn't. It assumes that the storage is going to stay forever. That number is not associated really with the object. That number is actually associated with the storage frame that contains the object.
Is the entire storage frame going to stay?
Yes. Page frames don't go away unless you take a sledgehammer to your disk. If you do that, we have bigger problems than worrying about whether the capability will respond. I think. Okay. I should probably acknowledge that it may be that my distaste for a revocable copy comes from two places, and one of these is non-scientific, and so I sort of want to, you know, expose it for you to be aware of it and therefore suspicious of my view. Right? The simple one is, I've spent a long time working in systems that don't do this, and I really understand the semantics of those systems, and I don't think anybody really understands the semantics of these systems, and I'll explain that in a minute. That's the one you should treat with suspicion. I have a good anecdote for why it's credible, but that's not the same as knowing. The other is, this operation requires storage allocation in the kernel, and I've got a lot of experience about why that's a bad idea. And there's a lot of industrial experience about why that's a bad idea. So the problem with this operation is it is foundationally an operation that supports denial of service because it requires an allocation of kernel resource. Now, if the L4 folks are able to successfully demonstrate their idea of a user-backed kernel heap, that objection might be removed. But as of today, it is unclear whether that design is feasible. It's credible, and they're working on it, and we'll know in about 3 years. Because it's tricky to get this stuff right. Okay. Now, since I happen to have a few more nails lying around, let me try to put a few more nails in this coffin. I send a revocable copy to you. What happens when I exit? Okay, so here's the scenario. The operation we have is revocable copy. A sends to B. B sends to C. B exits. Now what? I should make very clear that revocable copy means I get to revoke anybody downstream from me, not I get to revoke everybody. It's that I can take the copy back, not that I can destroy the object. The authority to destroy the object is a separation. So, if B had also performed a revocable copy to D, and B wished to revoke, right? B could take back the copies from C and D, but not the one from F. Right? Revocable copy sets up a tree that follows the pattern of the copies. Alright, so B wishes to exit. What happens to the capability held by C?
Does A know that C has a copy?
Nope. A does not know what B has done with the capability. That would be a violation of encapsulation, which, by the way, is sometimes going to be very uncomfortable, but it's a design rule we really want to maintain.
Presumably C will eventually end, so why is this different than the case that B doesn't finish before C does?
Sorry, say again?
Presumably C will end eventually.
C will eventually exit.
C will finish, it'll exit. So
yeah.
Then why is the fact that B, killed itself before C did, different than B actually lasting longer than C and never calling revoke?
Because if A wants to revoke...
Sorry. So the question is, really, why is this dependent on B? Why can't B just go away, leaving the capability with C? Right, is that really what you're asking? Go ahead.
I think that it's because if A decides at some point that it wants to revoke, it should be able to revoke the copies from... If it revokes its copy from B, then it should get the copies from C and D as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If I revoke, it's a complete recursive revoke down that part of the tree.
Right. So if A decides it wants to revoke, then it should be able to get all the copies from B, C, and D. But once B is exited, there's no path from A to C and D, since A doesn't directly know about them. So when A tries to revoke, C and D keep their copies. Right?
But there's a mechanism that connects A to C.
Good. Okay, let me see if I can tie this down. Okay. So, the first thing to notice, right, is that the received copy of the capability is not the same capability that was sent. It's a contingent copy. There's no value semantics here. It's not what's going on. And there are two feasible designs when B exits. The first would say, well, if B is gone and your copy is contingent on B, sorry, you lose it. And that's what happens in L4. The other option is to say, B, effectively, has the option not to revoke. And so when B exits, by not revoking, B is saying, I'm going to drop out of the revocation tree, and all of my children in the revocation tree should get reparented to whoever my parent is. And the reason this might be an issue is your assumption that C exits might be wrong. C might be a demon. There's a problem with this. I mean, it's a viable technical design. In fact, I think from a purely technical perspective, it's a more sensible design than the particular one that the L4 guys did. It is more complicated. It makes exit very expensive. But the real problem is now A has no knowledge about who has these capabilities and what might be the consequences of revoking them. The only guy who had that knowledge was B, and B is gone.
Why should A care about the consequences when it comes time to revoke?
Perhaps A should not. Certainly, if A was ever planning to revoke at all, the situation has not changed. But if we wanted to do an orderly, friendly revocation, we've now lost the ability to do it. What's your... Yes?
As the exceptional case of this...
Sorry. Okay.
As the exceptional case of this, what happens if it were A that were exiting... and it has given revocable copies.
Oh, if A is the originator and it exits,
right.
So A is the originator of this capability,
yeah.
The ultimate originator. Okay, now we got a problem. Now we have to revoke.
Okay.
No. Well, it depends on how we handle storage. It might be that A will exit, but A's storage allocator will not. Right. The problem at that point is we've lost the root of the revocation tree, and an interesting property of this is now we have a situation where the ultimate root of the revocation tree, if our proposal is that B can drop out, we're saying the ultimate root of the revocation tree somehow behaves differently from a subroot of a subtree. Root of a subtree. Now we could re-rationalize that. We could say, hey, look, if the real root drops out, those things, you know, reparent to some hypothetical system-wide root. And what this means is subtrees are now revocable, and if you want to whack the whole thing, you've got to destroy the object. And that's not crazy. It's awkward, but it's not crazy. Okay.
In terms of implementation for reparenting, so A is keeping track of the capabilities that it's given out in the kernel area of its memory space, right?
Yeah, where the kernel's keeping track on its behalf.
Right. So is the problem here that it's not feasible for when B dies for this memory to be up in this data structure?
Oh, no, it's very feasible. We're just going to do a tree reparenting. It's a very simple tree data structure.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering what the interface for A, when it's examining what capabilities it's handed out, would be like. Would it be?
It can't examine what capabilities it's handed out.
Right. So it doesn't. Okay.
It's just a tree pointer update inside the kernel. Now, there may be a lot of trees involved. Okay.
General question about revocable copy. If A revokes, if A is given it to B and to E, if it revokes from B, does it revoke from E also or not necessarily?
Okay, so you want to extend this tree. A has now given a copy to E, which has no knowledge of B, C, and D. And can A revoke just from B? The answer is it depends on the details of how we implement the operation. In the L4 case, if A wanted the ability to do that, what A would do, it would first map to itself so that it had a second copy. A is now, in effect, a child of A in the tree. It would then map from that to E. Okay? That answer your question?
So
you can arrange for this selectivity to be possible.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a pain. At that point, notice you've effectively done all of the steps that you would have needed to install an intervening wrapper object. Right? So this story is more convenient really only in the case where you plan to revoke everything below you. Right. So, in particular, it's convenient if you believe that there's some fundamental property about system structure that favors hierarchy. And indeed, there may be such a property. Right. It's a very, very strong argument to be made that property does, in fact, exist. If people aren't nice, I'll actually make you read the paper. It's a wonderful foundational paper by Herb Simon, who died just recently. It's called The Architecture of Complexity. Herb is known in our community for his work in AI, but he's also received top honors, including the Nobel Equivalent Prize in Economics, the top honor of the American Psychological Equivalent Group, the ACM Turing Award. All right, I mean, this guy was really a total nebbish, right? He didn't get top awards like in 8 different fields. Pretty amazing guy. And this particular paper is considered a seminal paper of his, and it's a very straightforward read. Maybe I will make copies of it just because it's something everybody should see, right? And it's an easy read. So the answer is it's possible. But this structure has foundational advantage really only if we're doing hierarchy. Okay, now we're making an assumption though here that not only are we doing a hierarchy of communication, but that as a consequence we're doing in some sense a hierarchy of dominance. This is the part where we do S&M, right? I bet you didn't know we did S&M in computer science. Well, we don't, sorry. Maybe next year. I'll propose that for the curriculum committee. Let's see what happens. Maybe not. So there's an assumption here that A, communication is hierarchical, and B, relationships are hierarchical. And I want to suggest that is sometimes true, but not universally true. And let me give you a counterexample. Microsoft Word loads, at last glance, about 150 ActiveX objects every time you open up Word. But you didn't know that. Most of them don't have any visual component whatsoever. Many of them do. But as far as you're concerned, this is a single unit of failure. It's a single application. Right? There is no, from a security perspective, there's no dominance relationship between these objects. Right? They're all in the same security domain. That, by the way, is a flaw. But certainly, if two of those sub-objects or subsystems hold the same capability, right? The story that they're not able to communicate with each other, or you know, or that one should be distinguished from the other, is mostly pretty absurd. Because in this situation, if I get into a situation where I want to revoke authority from a subpart of my own application, what this means is I'm killing the subpart. And if I'm killing the subpart, I'm just going to destroy it. I don't need to worry about revoking this capability in any special way. So what I want to suggest is that if you actually look at the overall structure of a system, this is by far the exceptional situation. Most relationships in the system in which a capability is transferred are either peer relationships, peers with respect to trust issues. Trust is fully symmetric. Or there's subsystem issues, but the right control mechanism is destruction, not reclamation, not revocation. Destruction of the subsystem. Or there's a relationship where I send a capability to somebody who is actually in a higher position of trust than I am. For example, right, I may send a capability to a bitmap that I hold to the Windows server. The Windows server may read from that. And you know what? If the Windows server is out to get me, I get bigger problems than worrying about what it does with my lousy little bitmap. The chances that I can recover it all are slim, but if I'm in the position where I have to recover from that, let me tell you, whacking the bitmap is not going to be high on my list of worries. I'm going to whack the bitmap, because the recovery model here is much bigger than this. I've just lost my channel to the user. So there are two reasons that I prefer using copy as the primitive operation. One is, from experience, I think it's by far the more common operation, and not by a little bit, by like a 10-to-1 ratio or more. Actually, I think it's more, but we don't have hard insurance. The other is that in the event that I want a revocable copy, I can get it. And the way it works is, here's the capability that I hold. I want to give you a revocable copy. I buy this thing called a wrapper object. This is a completely transparent wrapping of the object. You'll never know it exists. Okay. And what I do is, I hand the wrapper object to you. You can now invoke the original. And the reason I do this is because I can now destroy the wrapper object. And if I destroy the wrapper object, I sever your connection to the original object. And that's exactly what I would have done if I had revoked the copy. Now, is that expensive? Yes, I have to buy a resource. That's going to involve an IPC operation. So it's about 3 times as expensive to do this, at least, as it is to simply send you a capability. And if we think the ratio is 10 to 1, that's a little uncomfortable. Somewhere around 20 to 1, I'm going to stop worrying about it. But let's look at this the other way. What do I have to do if I actually want to do the non-revocable copy? For example, I would like the grace of being able to exit without taking you with me. You might like that too. Well, what I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to do a multi-phase protocol here where A is going to send a message to B containing some capability to some object. I don't care what the object is. That's not important here. B is now going to receive a revocable copy because that was the primitive operation. And B is now going to have to find a way to get a copy that A can't revoke. Okay. So one way we could do that is we could introduce a universally accessible capability server. And what's going to happen is B is going to take this capability and execute a capability exchange protocol. And then the cost of this is every time we create an object, we're going to have to contact the CAP server and say, there's a new object in the world, and we need to know that. Problem with that is, in order for me to create an object, I need authority to allocate storage out of the CAP server. And the CAP server cannot run on my storage because then I can revoke it. This is a global denial of resource problem in Scotland. And you know, the sort of the listening analogy between capability exchange and needle exchange is not an accident, right? Using clean needles is better than using dirty needles, right? But it would be better to just get clean needles in the first place. Frankly, it'd probably be better not to be using needles, but given the difference between dirty and clean, I'll take clean. Inhale it, and that's the way to go. Okay, now maybe.
In this story, will you copy the capability?
Eric shakes his head in total disbelief, right? And he's been listening to me do these bad metaphors for years.
In that story, will you copy the capability in the wrapper object?
Yeah.
So this means that A gives the wrapper object to B. Both A and B can destroy the containing object.
Both you. So your issue is both A or B could destroy the wrapper. Yes. Sorry, could destroy what?
Even the inner object, not the wrapper.
So if the inside object provides a destroy operation, then either side could invoke it. Yes. And that was true whether we wrap the capability or not. Furthermore, if the wrapper capability provides a destroy option, then at least so far, in the story I've told, either side could invoke it. And if we want to prevent that, it might be that A has to build the wrapper, and get two wrapper capabilities, one that allows A to destroy the wrapper, right, and a second that allows B to invoke but does not allow B to destroy. And that turns out to be not at all hard to do. In fact, it's the normal case. As to the object, in the same way, we could exploit the protected payload in this inner capability and say, well, when I hand out the object to you, I will hand you a version that just does not obey the destroy request. But yes, I have to be a little cautious about that. Look, if you don't want me to run certain operations in the object, don't give me the capability that authorizes those operations. When you give me that capability, you're giving me a license to do what those operations permit. So, this CAP server ignoring issues of performance might look like a good idea, except then we've got to deal with denial of resource. And if we think that most of the relationships in the world that capabilities flow over are peer relationships, then what we've got here is a three IPC protocol that's going to happen on 95%+ of the exchanges. That would not be my preferred choice. Now, you could say, hey, I'd like both operations. And if the kernel heaps idea works out, that might be a fine way to go. And the kernel heaps idea was something that the L4 folks came up with that we looked at doing in Kyotos that last time I talked to him, Eric, I believe, would still like to do in Kyotos. Is that still the case? You're kind of debating. Okay. And I made the decision that we were not going to do it, not because I think it's a bad idea, okay, but because when you're out exploring the swamp, you don't lead two parties into the deep part at the same time. And also because I think we just barely know how to do a formal verification for a system that doesn't have kernel heaps. I am pretty sure we don't know how to do a verification for a system that does have kernel heaps. And in my sort of pantheon of research priorities, the verification is at the top. We know we can build a system that works adequately well without that in the kernel. It might work better with that in the kernel, and making the switch is a contained issue. It's not an, it's, it's a big issue in the kernel implementation, but it's not a big pervasive issue in the system architecture. So that's an experiment that I think I'd like to defer based on what the L4 folks learn, and then make it a C. Okay. So when we did the intro OS course, those of you poor victims who did it with me, you may have noticed that aside from ranting about it, maybe when I did the discussion about arrows, I didn't talk much about storage allocation. And I certainly didn't talk much about storage resource denial. Not worrying about resource denial is fine if you don't actually care if the system runs. Now, you're smiling, and it's meant to be a little funny, but in fact, most of us don't care. Right? The systems run well enough. And in fact, if you're in a friendly environment, perfectly reasonable to say, look, I'm not out to get myself. I probably want a little bit of a reserve mechanism, not because I'm worried about somebody breaking one of my programs, but because I'd like to hold back enough reserve that if something goes wrong, I can at least kill it. Right? So the test here is, the program going wrong shouldn't be so successful at thrashing the system that I can't log in to kill it. And anybody who's run a Unix system long enough has experienced that bug. I hear a chuckle. Never happens, does it? Right. Reset switch, the ultimate kill. Okay, so, I mean, there is even in a friendly system, right, you want some mechanism for disaster recovery, but it's a mechanism that, you know, one out of a billion users will use. Most of them won't know it's there, right, and it's one that you really hope never to pull the trigger on. Okay, this is the small talk worldview. This is the X-Windows system worldview. In fact, except that they left that in reserve. It's not a bad worldview, right? However, do not connect this machine to the internet. Do not install shrink wrap software. That would unfortunately include Windows. Do not, these days, curious problem, it's not clear that you can afford to connect that system to the power grid. IPMI is a communication channel that runs over your power line in its next generation form. Right? The reason it's there is so that people in large machine rooms can go to their power switches and inquire from the power switch, hey, I have 3,000 servers somewhere in this room. Where's Fred? And you laugh, but when you got 3,000 machines in the room being managed by several people, you know, the machines move overnight. You know, it's not gremlins, right? It's the night crew. But still, when Fred goes down, you need to know where it got to. Okay? The resemblance between the night crew and gremlins is actually surprising, too. Don't feed them water. They get really nasty. Okay, that's it. We're also going to do a midnight screening of Gremlins. Okay. I mean, it's not clear how much longer you can afford to attach this thing to the power line. You think I can't run IPMI over the power grid to your house? I probably can't today. I haven't put a lot of thought into it. But we know that people are doing this over cable networks down your street. Why do you believe the power grid is exempt? Right? The power grid's becoming a broadcast network. Christ, people are looking at running broadband over power lines. Right? And I promise you, if that becomes popular, it'll get integrated onto your motherboard. Okay, so aside from not connecting into the network, not running any software, and not plugging it in, I think you're in good shape. I am painting a caricature. But the fact is that Microsoft has, not on purpose, but they have shipped CDs that have had viruses on the Golden Masters. And they are, in fact, one of the most diligent companies in the world about this. And they've become much more so lately. We all love to pick on Microsoft, and God knows I'm no exception. But in fact, they're working really hard on this, and they're making tremendous advances. But when you have a process involving that many people and that much complexity, there are a lot of cracks. It's not because they're bad guys. And it's not because they're not paying attention. Okay, so I actually think that if we're going to engineer robust and survivable systems, getting back to the point, we actually need to deal with resource denial. And when you admit considerations of resource denial into your system design, this is the punchline, life suddenly becomes complicated. IDC is really easy to design if it doesn't have to work. And it's almost as easy to design if it doesn't have to work in the face of adversity. And it's rather more tricky when you actually care. We have a couple of tools for this, right? And they mostly involve sticking to designs that don't do dynamic resource allocation behind your back, and that when they do, the resource allocation is accounted for, and that the primitive operations at least really avoid doing that. That is a different design discipline from the one that we teach in an undergraduate or even a graduate program. Right? Almost the first operation you learn about in Java after you do syntax is new. Why? Because you can't do anything in Java without calling new. Right? And this is great if you want to build huge reams of unmaintainable code fast, which is what most of us do for a living. It's not so good if you want to survive the results. There are safe idioms for using new. We don't teach them. I'll talk some more about that tomorrow. Anyway, look, so I want to propose that the right, and I know we're over time, I want to propose that for reasons of frequency, okay, and for reasons of design robustness, actually the right primitive here is a copy. With apologies to your intuitions and your sensibility, both of which are reasonable positions. Okay. Most of the reason I believe that is that my experience suggests that most of these relationships are peer relationships, and I have to acknowledge that depends heavily on how you're designing the system. And also, that in most of the cases where I'm ultimately going to want a revocation, I'm going to have a reference monitor in the loop anyway. The reference monitor is going to be in a position to inject the wrappers, and that means that to some degree, the design is tolerant of my forgetting. And if you didn't have the ability to sort of localize that responsibility, I would think that relying on pure copy as opposed to revocable copy would be a much less responsible design position. And I don't know how to do this in a robust system, which admittedly should be a big factor in the design, but that might change in the next 2 or 3 years people are looking at it. All right, so we'll come back to this tomorrow. Thank you. And I have not forgotten that I owe you some accountability for what's going to be on the midterm, and for the moment I will only ask you not to panic.